FM and AM stations worldwide on the leading independent community and music radio stations on the planet. This program originates at WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Ohio, USA. For correspondence or QSL, contact Brad at thesummit.fm. Thank you for supporting independent, eclectic radio broadcasting and signals over the air from all corners of planet Earth. One broadcast to an audience of many, simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. Join us next time for the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisella, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisella and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. A good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisella's work, and for you too, is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, so that after all the choices that they have, they decided that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them. And I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes. They're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter in Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station. WRCT is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storm, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give him my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We hung out for a weekend. 58 or so. Bill Motzen, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is a jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He was one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to 5 or 6 people. It's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio when a quintet was playing in the studio and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in the group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there at the moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things. And I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and the musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes. And I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space, where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage that the sound cannot be as impactful or as starting and sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound, by the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from David Gage in New York, yeah. A realist that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, mm-hmm. all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take, Richard, if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, mm-hmm. say the big top five orchestras, mm-hmm. from 1957 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you find mm-hmm. on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical mm-hmm. songs and other. Have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, mm-hmm. school or high school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to handle the Hollywood chorus, or mm-hmm. they may have a Brandenburg society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups that I play as many as I can, as my schedule allows, and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, and this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings, you know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I've always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm a Oscar Peterson fan. And, of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts two more records. I got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play. Just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the hour to a recent publication by two of our co-hosts, Michael Smith and Jim Lafferty. One of the contributors, Professor Bill Mullen, joins us as well.
The book is titled From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism, American Style. This anthology is a wide-ranging collection of seven essays exploring the rise of fascism in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, is the title of a recently published anthology edited by Zachary Sklar and our own Michael Smith. Co-host Jim Lafferty wrote the introduction. The book draws from seven key interviews with prominent socialist thinkers in the United States and Canada. They include Margaret Kimberly, Henry Giroux, Diane Feeley, and Bill Mullen. Bill will also be joining Michael and Jim in the guest seat. He's Professor Emeritus of American Studies at Purdue University and the author of We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law. Chris Hedges, who is also included in this book, writes, quote, "When fascism comes to America, it will be massive recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance, the Christian cross, and the flag." We'll explore these frayed boundaries of Christian fascism, capitalism, and the assault on free speech and censorship, while also highlighting the strategies of community-based actions. Michael, Bill, and Jim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Glad to
be here. Thanks, Heidi. Good to be here.
Michael, let's start with you. Fascism has been defined as an ultranationalist and authoritarian political philosophy characterized by a dictatorial leader, a strong central government, militarism, the forceful suppression of opposition, a belief in natural social hierarchy, racism, and the subordination of individual interests to the perceived interests of the nation. And it rejects liberal democratic principles. Fascism is racist, homophobic, and misogynistic. It makes use of scapegoats. By this definition, is the United States a truly fascistic nation today?
Do we have fascism in America? Not yet. I emphasize not yet. We start off our book with a quote from the great German playwright Bertolt Brecht, who said, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" Capitalism cannot make for a decent way of life for most people in our country. Real wages haven't gone up in 50 years. The minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. The three richest people in America own as much as the bottom half. People live from paycheck to paycheck, from hand to mouth. They couldn't survive a $500 crisis. The unions were broken way back in 1947 and are not much of a force anymore. Union membership then was about a third. Now it's down to 11%, with 6% being in the public sector. Starting with Clinton, the deindustrialization costs us 30 million jobs. People are in despair. Despair is what fascism plays on. But fascism doesn't come in a snap. It's not like turning off the lights. It's a process. I emphasize a process. And that process is going on now. So do we have fascism? Not yet. But Trump and the forces around him are consolidating power. There's a German word for it. It's called Gleichschaltung. It means bringing it into line. So far, Trump has brought into line the big law firms, the media, a lot of our judges, universities like Columbia, state legislatures, the Congress, and a compliant Supreme Court, which just gave immunity for all Trump's, quote, official acts. The system that we used to have of checks and balances is being destroyed. Trump issues executive orders. He goes under the theory of a unified executive. And just 2 weeks ago, quite alarmingly, Trump figured out a way to avoid the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the use of the military domestically. And he called in the National Guard, first in California and then in Washington, D.C., to scare people. He used the false pretext of a crime wave, which is literally not true. He now threatens to use the National Guard in other cities like Baltimore and Chicago. So the answer to your question, Heidi, is not yet. Fascism is not yet here. It's a process. It takes a while to consolidate it. We're not there yet, but we're well on our way. That's why we wrote the book. And I just wanted to remind people, the book is called From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. And it can be had from Orr Books, orrbooks.com.
Bill, the German scholar and political philosopher Ernst Frankl postulated that at the start, Germany was what he called a dual state, a fascist country. Explain to our listeners what he meant by that, what relevance, if any, it has to what is happening in the United States today.
Thanks, Stephen. That's a great question. I turned to Frankl because I felt like his analysis of the dual state very much helped understand the moment that we're living in. Frankl proposed that under German fascism, there were two forms of law. There was what he called normative law, which was basically the courts, judiciary, the legal system that was meant to sustain the operations of capitalism. Then there was something he called prerogative law. And that was the codes of law that the Third Reich created, essentially to punish internal enemies, to legislate racism, to deport unwanted citizens, to criminalize homosexuals, to stigmatize Jews, and ultimately to rationalize and give legal cover to the Holocaust. And I believe that when Frankl argued, is that these two forms of law, normative and prerogative, under the Third Reich, helped to sustain each other. In other words, that Hitler's use of prerogative law to scapegoat Jews and to convince industrial capitalists that this was a good program meant that there was two sides, as it were, to the operations of fascism and that they were co-constituting. I think that's very much what we see with the Trump administration. We see Trump essentially trying to sustain capitalism. He's not using the same techniques, obviously, as the Third Reich. He's using things like tariffs and other modes of law. But he's very much using prerogative law in a variety of forms to try to win business leaders, CEOs, tech capitalists to his program. For example, the use of executive orders right now, which are being used to deport and criminalize what he calls internal aliens. That's a great example of what Frankl called prerogative law. The executive order itself means the president is above the Congress or any other body who might interfere with his attempts to use law to carry out an agenda. We also see this in the attempted use of things like posse comitatus. Mike has talked about the deployment of troops through executive order in the name of fighting crime. This criminalization process is very much meant to do two things, I think, in this current moment. One is to, again, use fear and intimidation to continue to win and coerce people to the Trumpian agenda. It's also an attempt to crush any resistance to the capitalist experience that people are having right now. And again, this is what Frankl understood. He understood that prerogative law was a way of smashing down against anyone who might oppose the capitalist order as it was being expressed through fascism. He was himself a democratic socialist. He actually had a background as a lawyer in the labor movement, oftentimes defending Jewish clients against the state. So his analysis was a class-based analysis of the law. And the last thing I'll say about it, and this kind of feeds into other things that I talk about elsewhere, and we'll probably talk about more, he was really trying to expose the, what we call the rule of law as something that was highly manipulable, was always in the interest of the powerful, and could actually help open the door for fascism. We think of the rule of law as something that can just kind of put a brake on the possibilities of authoritarianism. He was actually interested in showing us how it was an active mechanism of advancing a fascist agenda. And I believe that that's also very much in line with what I would call Trump's experiment in fascism, i.e., how far can I bend the law, use the law, how prerogative can I be in my exercise of the law to advance authoritarianism? And again, I would agree with Michael, we're not to fascism yet, but I believe that these are the baby steps being taken with the mechanism of law to move us in that direction.
Jim, as you know, Trump won both the electoral and the popular vote. He was relatively clear about what he would do if elected. And since being elected, he has done what he claimed he would do. My question is this, and it dovetails with Bill's last comment. Can a nation democratically elect its way into fascism?
Well, that's a good question. And it's true that he did campaign openly on his war against immigrants, et cetera, the national debt and what have you. But he didn't get into any detail in terms of how he would go about doing that, what he was campaigning on. He's really at this point following the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 report, which encompasses many, many more proposed changes than Trump talked about when he was running for office. I mean, when Trump was running for office, he didn't say to the American people, hey, I'm going to cut 12 million people off of Medicaid. He didn't say what he talk about what he was going to do to the universities, as Michael was talking about earlier. He said a power grab, really, of what would normally be the power of Congress. I mean, we have this separation of powers in this country. He's stepped all over that. He's refused to dispense money that Congress has approved to be dispensed. He's cut the staff of so many federal agencies, which hurts people. If you want to call Social Security, you want to call the Veterans Administration for help, you're going to have a hell of a harder time getting it now than you would have before all these massive cuts in the federal staffing. He constantly violates the Constitution, separation of powers, really. He's not a king, but he behaves like a king from time to time. His cabinet meetings, indeed, are filled with mostly sycophant praise, as he says, without contradiction, as he did at the last one. And I quote, I can do anything I want to do. I'm the president of the United States, close quote. When he sends the military in, has been referred to, I mean, he's had at least a dozen, I think it is now, declarations of emergency, states of emergency, he calls them. I think it's almost a dozen at this point, where he says he can therefore deport immigrants without due process of law because it's emergency. You know, he's fighting the supposedly Venezuelan gang invasion, which of course is a myth. He can dispatch federal troops, as he did here in June, to here in L.A., where I'm speaking from, and into D.C. now. Why? Because, well, it's an emergency to quell protests and fight crime. Crime is down in both of those cities. The protests are peaceful, of course. He can ask the Supreme Court for emergency rulings because he can't afford to wait for judges to debate his policies and so forth. It's true that he campaigned in broad strokes on some of the things he was going to do. In the details is where we find the harm that he's done to constitutional governance in the United States. Look what he's just done on the question of our own history and the question of knowledge of what our history has been in this country. Look what he's done to the Smithsonian, where he's had them rewrite so much of our history so as to temper those parts of our history that he doesn't want to have really told at all. He's done the same thing in our national parks. He didn't campaign on doing that. He didn't campaign on what he's done to the universities, wanting to even determine what their curriculum will be. He didn't campaign on using the excuse of peaceful protest around Palestine and Israel to make bogus claims of anti-Semitism and use that to strip millions and millions and millions of dollars from our universities. So while it's fair to say that he campaigned in broad strokes on some of the things he would be doing, the devil is indeed in the details, and the details were not something he campaigned on.
Michael, your book, and I have to say, it's such a contribution to what we're going through right now, and I applaud you and Jim and the authors of the various essays. You entitle it From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. One of those featured in the books, the journalist Chris Hedges, writes frequently about the Christian right. What role has the Christian right played in producing what he says in your book is a fascistic Christian nationalism?
What role do they play? A major role. They make up the base of Trump's support. Remember, Trump got 74 million votes in 2020 and 2 million more, 76 million votes in 2024. Steve, I wanted to read to our audience a couple of paragraphs of what we wrote as introduction to Chris Hedges' chapter called The Rise of Christian Fascism. The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. It's a sobering thought to reflect on the fact that Trump received 74 million votes in 2020 and 76 million votes in 2024. Trump himself is a hollow man, devoid of any feelings of human solidarity. Programmatically, he stands for nothing but his own self-advancement. Trump bragged that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. He's a product of his connections to the mafia, City Hall, and the tabloid yellow sleaze media like Fox News. When she divorced him, first wife Ivanka said that he kept a copy of Hitler's speeches at his bedside. An allegation in her complaint was that he raped her. As a businessman, he was a con artist and a cheat. Although ignorant and quite obviously mean-spirited, Trump is an extremely effective orator, as was Hitler. He has an extensive following and makes money for the networks who give him all the time he wants on the basis that, quote, might not be good for America, but it's good for CBS, in the infamous quote of Leslie Moonves, the former head of CBS. And I just wanted to end with this final thought that we had about Trump. Consequently, millions of followers are ignorant and support Trump regardless of the harm he will do them. His denial of man-made climate change is already leading to human extinction. These are cult supporters of Trump. They don't merely support him politically. They venerate him. When Trump was running back in 2016, he was caught on a hot mic talking about what he could do to women. And we have a comparison I think we could make to show that Trump is more than a politician, that he's a cult figure. I want to compare Trump to the hapless Gary Hart. Some of our listeners may remember that Gary Hart was a senator from Colorado. And years ago, he was running in 1988. He was running for president. He was tall, handsome, articulate, a liberal, a very popular guy. And here's what happened to him. He was on a yacht with a lovely woman named Donna Rice. A photographer caught them and snapped a photograph of the two of them. And in the photograph, he captured the name of the yacht. The yacht was called Monkey Business. That photograph was flashed all over the country. And Gary Hart was a dead dog. He didn't run for president. But Trump is different. And that's why I think that it's more than just a politician like Hart. He's a cult figure. He's always given a pass. He was caught messing around with the porn star Stormy Daniels while his wife was sitting at home waiting for him. He's all wrapped up in the Epstein scandal, but I believe he's going to get away with it. He stiffed his suppliers when they built his resorts in New Jersey. He was caught making fun of disabled reporters. All this goes by the boards because he's not a normal politician. He's a cult figure. And I wanted to end with this thought. Chris Hedges says, you can't talk people out of supporting Trump. You can't talk them out of it. What you need to do is present them with a program that will help them. Like Mamdani, his program of free buses, childcare, rent freezes, taxing the rich. Or like Shama Sawant in our book, who as city councilwoman did a rent freeze and got $400 million in taxes called the Amazon tax and got an increase in the minimum wage. That's the kind of political program that we have to get and support, because that's what's going to defeat fascism, nothing less.
Bill, let's turn to you for a moment. Another author and a frequent guest on Law and Disorder is Richard Wolff. The New York Times claims he's the leading Marxist economist in the United States today. What is the relationship between capitalism and democracy?
Well, I think it's a very tenuous one, because as we all know, capitalism is driven by a profit motive, which presumes inequality. Someone is going to gain more than someone else. There's no reason to be a capitalist unless that's your motivation. Democracy is premised on the idea that all people are equal and have equal opportunity. And there's a massive contradiction between these two principles. I think what we've seen historically is that capitalism has succeeded by managing democracy in its own interest. And what I mean by that is, and we can talk about the current moment if we'd like to, we talk now about we live in an age of oligarchs. What that really means is that democracy has kind of been emptied out. We recognize that power and wealth have been funneled upward. Clearly, Trump is doing everything he can as an oligarch to evacuate what we might call civil society, stripping people of their individual rights, according to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, to live in this country as a citizen, the right to live here in peace. It's a full-out, Trump manifests, I would argue, perhaps better than anybody in certainly in the 21st century, this contradiction between capitalism and democracy that I began with. He clearly is a person whose interest is a ruling class interest. And what I mean by that is he takes very seriously the premise that the only kind of society we can have is one in which there are powerful people on top and much less powerful people underneath. So that's one thing I would say about the relationship. The second thing I would say, and this kind of gets to Michael's point, democracy can be a real challenge to capitalism, but it has to be done by dismantling it. We have to actually get at the root of the profit motive and put people before profit. This was really, you know, Marx's insight, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. We must construct a society which actually is democratic, which actually applies the notion of equality at birth, which applies the notion that that all boats rise together. It's the exact opposite, really, when you think about it, of how capitalism functions. And so I say that because, for me, as a socialist, I'm a socialist because I think socialism is the most democratic expression of opposition to capitalism. It really tears it up from the root, dismantles its hierarchies, dismantles its motivation, which is the upward mobility of wealth at the expense of the many. I really agree with Michael's point towards the end there. Our best chance of defeating fascism and Trumpism is actually a full-on assault on capitalism itself. This has really been, you know, this was the fundamental insight of Trotsky about 100 years ago. He said, only the working class organized can be a break on fascism. It must take power, because fascism ultimately is an expression of capitalism. It's the expression of capitalism kind of run amok with that oligarch class having virtually all of the political power and control over social relationships. So that's the direction I would argue that we need to go to disentangle capitalism and democracy as we are living them now.
Jim, building on that, German fascism was an alliance between the very rich and lower middle class. Hitler betrayed that alliance with the lower middle class and its program in what is known as the Night of the Long Knives. Please talk about that. Do you think that the American lower middle class supporters of Trump are in for the same treatment? And why do they seem to vote against their own best interests?
Well, yes, let's go back over that a little bit. One is reminded, of course, that Hitler's Nazi Party, for example, became the largest party in the Reichstag in 1932. It became the largest party in the Reichstag with only 37% of the vote, their highest ever. Hitler was then, January of 1933, appointed chancellor. And then the Night of the Long Knives, as you referenced, was a purge that took place in Nazi Germany in late June and early July of the following year, 1934. At that time, Hitler and the Nazi regime eliminated many of its political opponents, primarily within the Nazi Party itself. Well, we see what Trump has done, of course, with the Republican Party. Now, they haven't been assassinated, as was the case under Hitler, but they've been rendered mute or eliminated from the party itself. Trump has been doing the same, as I say, without the killings. He's made the Republican Party, the Republican Congress, totally subservient to him. He's been able to get rid of those in government not marching to his tune. His big, beautiful bill is a gift to his billionaire friends at the expense of the lower middle classes who voted for him. I don't think there's any doubt about who prospers and who profits quite directly from the programs of Trump and the Trump administration and is not the factory worker. He got 45% of the union vote, which depresses me greatly because he's hell-bent on destroying the unions in this country. He's already stripped, close to a million federal workers of their rights to have a union. So the effects of what he has done so far are certainly contrary to the interests of those who voted for him, other than the billionaire class, which is, of course, what it's all about. And as Bill was just talking about in terms of what the role that capitalism plays in all of this. Much of this, of course, in terms of the harm to the middle class, is not going to be as evident yet. It will be more evident after, sadly, the 2026 congressional elections. And that election itself, I think, will most assuredly be an undemocratic election, as are, frankly, the elections in America anyway. But and particularly so in the 2026 elections because of the racist and political gerrymandering, which will result in, well, more congressional districts being in Republican-populated districts. By the way, it's interesting to note in that regard, going back to Germany for a moment in the Reichstag, that the Reichstag, by a two-thirds majority vote, passed the Enabling Act in 1933, which gave Hitler, what, dictatorial powers to enact laws without parliamentary approval. And today in America, the Republican-controlled Congress says little or nothing when Trump takes actions that effectively nullifies laws passed by Congress, violating the Constitution's separation of powers. And the Democrats, frankly, are not saying much either. Let me close with a quote on this question from Bill Mullen's essay in our book, From the Flag to the Cross. And by the way, I think Michael mentioned that earlier, but From the Flag to the Cross is published by OR Books. And one can go online at www.orbooks.com, find From the Flag to the Cross, it's reasonably priced, find many, many other wonderful books as well on of a political nature. But here's what Bill says on page 70 of From the Flag to the Cross, and I quote, "One of the myths of American democracy is that the rule of law will save us from things like dictatorship. But in fact, German fascism and Italian fascism both used the courts and the law specifically to implement fascist rule. Some of that was actually borrowed from the United States. For example, German jurisprudence during the Nazi years borrowed heavily from American Jim Crow law," close quote. And I'll end with that.
Turning back to Michael, when a fascist leader solidifies power, is there any example we can find in history of that man being voted out?
When a fascist seizes power, is there any example? No, 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 no. There is no example. Francisco Franco, the Spanish dictator, came to power violently in 1939, and he stayed there until 1975, and he died in his bed. Same with Portuguese fascist dictator Salazar. Hitler was not voted out of power either. When he was faced with military defeat from the Russian army to his east and the American and Allied forces to his west, he committed suicide in his bunker. Italy's Mussolini was overwhelmed by Allied forces after 21 years in power. He was killed and hung upside down by his heels in a gas station. So the answer is no. Once a fascist leader gets into power, we have no hope of voting him out.
Why do you think the American labor movement is the most promising countervailing force to a complete fascist takeover in America? Do you see some hopeful signs in that movement?
Well, going back to my earlier comments about the nature of capitalism, fascism has only emerged so far in capitalist states. And one of the reasons is because fascists understand how to use capitalism as a system to concentrate power. As a socialist, I think that the labor, those of us who work with our hands and who we are actually creating the wealth ourselves that capitalism accumulates, which can lead to fascism. So the first step towards stepping away from fascism is to stop creating wealth for those who might become our overlords. Historically, the labor movement has lived on the premise that we are meant to keep as much of that which we create as we can.